My name is John. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Billy, for asking me to come out. Thanks, guys, for having me at your group. I want to thank all the guys who came down with me. Appreciate it. That's kind of what we were taught to do in our own group, you know. When somebody in our group is speaking or doing something for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, we come and show up for each other. So thanks, guys, for coming out. I'll start for my first drink. I'll start before that. I grew up in a pretty normal home. We had a lot of kids. There were six kids. We had one bathroom growing up, and everybody's 2 years apart, exactly 2 years apart. And so we were all in school at the same time. So we had to shower every morning, you know. So, and we would do it in shifts. And the first person would start at 4:30, and then, you know, we would change times, and so it stayed even. And that was kind of the way my house worked. You know, it was kind of hectic all the time. And, you know, everybody would scramble out the door and go to school and come back. My dad worked a lot. He was hardly ever home. He had three jobs, worked 36-hour shifts, you know, and my mom took care of us growing up, and she would have a glass of wine every night after she put us all to bed. And she drank that glass of wine, I found out, maybe a few years ago, because she was so intense from the day, you know, it just calmed her down. That one glass of wine helped her sleep at night, and that was not the reason that I drank, that's for sure. Or not the way that I drank. All my brothers were, you know, they were athletes. You know, I'm the second youngest, and they were all shining examples of kids growing up. You know, they were all stars in football and baseball, and you know, I wanted to be like them, but I was not like them at all. You know, I went to school, and instantly I had to be the best at everything. You know, I had to be the fastest runner, and I was pretty fast, and they gave me a nickname, Flash, and I loved it. That's what they all called me in elementary school. They called me Flash, and I loved it. I loved that name. You know, I was like the coolest guy. I was the fastest. Everybody wanted me to play kickball with them, and you know, that was good. Life was so good in elementary school. You know, I was like the center of attention, and this kid, Justin Egan, he came to my elementary school from Whitman, Massachusetts. He came over to Rockland Elementary Schools, and he was faster than me. And they started calling him Flash. And I lost the nickname, you know. I lost all my glory. And I'm pretty sure that was my first resentment. And so, you know, I was in competition with that guy for years, you know. And I developed different relationships with different people. And, you know, I found this one kid who acted out in school just like I did. He was a bad mouth to teachers, and so I started hanging out with this guy, and we would spend the weekends together. I would stay over at his house, and in the summer times we would sleep in his camper and in his backyard. And I was 11 or 12 years old, and his brother was 21, and he bought us some Rolling Rock beer, and I said, you know, I wasn't really interested in drinking. I didn't really know too much about it, you know, an effect produced by alcohol. I didn't know too much about it yet. And I took a sip of the beer, and it was disgusting. It was awful. And I didn't want to drink alcohol anymore. You know, I thought it was gross, you know. I liked, you know, soda and, you know, the good tasting stuff. And but I'll tell you what happened is I got so intense and so competitive with everybody that I was separating myself from everybody in my life, you know, at such a young age, at 13 years old. And, you know, I got kicked out of a couple of schools, and I got sent over to a alternative school. And all the kids there were like, you know, they all drank a lot. And so that's who I hung out with, you know, because those were like the cool guys in the school I was in. You know, they were all drinking, and I wanted to feel cool like them. And they were doing other stuff, and I tried some of that stuff, and I liked it a lot. And but they all drank, and I didn't want to drink beer anymore. You know, that's all I remember was the Rolling Rock beer I had. It was disgusting. And one night they brought Bacardi. And I like Bacardi. That was good. I drank that. It was Bacardi with a little lemon twist to it. And that was it for me. I loved it. You know, I mean, I had that sense of ease and comfort, you know, from the first drink. That's what I got. And I chased it for a long time. You know, that's all I wanted to do, was drink. And I stopped going to school. I convinced my dad it would be a good idea if I dropped out of school and worked. And, I mean, he was probably just done with me by that point. You know, I was expelled from a couple of different schools. And so I got this job at JCPenney. And I worked there for about 2 weeks, honestly. And then I started stealing money from the register. Because I wasn't making enough money to drink, you know. I didn't have enough money to make it through the weekend. I would get paid on Friday and lose money by Saturday, and I'd be out of money. And everybody would have money for Sunday except for me. So I started stealing money from the register, you know. And that's pretty much what I did every weekend was I drank Bacardi, you know. That was it. And I loved that feeling. I loved it. I wanted to do it all the time, you know. And that's what I did. I stopped going to school, I stopped showing up to work, and I was pretty much homeless, you know. One night I came home, and I don't remember if I was drunk or not, but I got in an argument with my dad about not showing up to work or not going to work anymore. And I was 16 years old, and he kicked me out of the house, and I don't know if he had expected me to leave or not, but I did. I left, and because, you know, I'm so arrogant, I was like, you know, I can take care of myself. I'm 16 years old. I didn't have a job, you know, I didn't have anything going for me. And all I did was stay over friends' houses. You know, one of my friends was, he was home tutored. He would get home tutored from 9 a.m. to noon every day. And I would sleep over at his house. He would wake me up at noontime, and his mom would leave $20 on the counter for him every day. And we'd buy a pack of cigarettes and some Thunderbird or whatever we could. And that's what I did every day. I was a loser. I didn't have anything going for me except the feeling I got from drinking, you know. I loved the way it made me feel, you know. I'm just like everybody else, you know. I drank for the effect produced by alcohol, you know. I didn't drink because I liked the taste, although I did like the taste of some stuff. But I drank to get that feeling of I fit in with everybody else, you know. I'm just like everybody else. But really, I wasn't at all, you know. I was definitely different from my brothers, from normal people in my life. You know, so I wasn't going home at all. I hadn't called or talked to my dad or any of my family members for 2 weeks, you know, and he put a warrant out for my missing. And this one woman's house we used to go over to, she had a police scanner, and I heard my name get called over the police scanner one day, saying that there was a warrant out for my missing. And I mean, I lived in a real small town, it's probably 500 people, and everybody knew everybody, you know, and I was like, man, I better go home tonight. And I got in my friend Craig's car, and we were doing some other stuff besides drinking that night. And I was going home, and the police pulled up behind us and saw me in the car, and they pulled us over and took me down to the police station. And that was kind of, you know, I felt a little bit at ease, you know, that I was caught, you know. And they didn't arrest me, but they took me down to the police station, and they were basically like, where have you been? What have you been doing? You smell like, you know, drugs. And I was, you know, I'm like, I'm not telling you guys anything, you know. And I was afraid they were going to beat me up, actually, like in the movies. And that was really the only real consequence I ever had. And, you know, I was like, I'm in the bail room where there's no video cameras, so like, you know, they can beat me up if they want to. But I was being belligerent, you know, as usual, you know. And they said, your father's out in the lobby waiting to take you home. And I was just like, you know, God, I don't want to see my dad. You know, I can't stand him. I couldn't stand him, you know. My dad was never really, he wasn't really ever around. So, you know, I don't even know if he would have, but he never really abused me physically, anything like that. He never did anything to hurt me, ever. And the only thing he ever did was he worked all the time, you know, to try to give us the life of a normal child. And he did a good job. And I spit in his face all the time, you know. And he brought me home, and I told him I hated him. I didn't really want anything to do with him. And the next day, I woke up, and I felt bad about saying that, you know. And I remember when I was like 10 or 11 years old, my dad used to hit his hands. He was a carpenter slash you know, everything else. And he would do some remodeling at our house, and he would like jam his finger in the door or hit it with a hammer or something. And if I had done that when I was that young, I would have started crying, right? So I asked him when he did that stuff. I said, why don't you cry when that happens? And he said, when my mom died, he said, I cried out all my tears. And he said, I haven't cried since my mother died. And that was when I was 10 or 11 years old. And that night, when he picked me up from the police station after I told him that, I went upstairs, kind of like, yeah, I told him, you know. And I heard him crying. You know, he was crying downstairs. He was actually sobbing, like, I mean, it was awful. It was terrible. I felt disgusting, you know. And I went into the bathroom and I was saying, I mean, I don't really know that I looked in the mirror and saw what I had become. I took a shower and I was thinking about the stuff I'd been doing for the past 2 years, you know. How much I had participated in my family's life, you know. And it wasn't very much, you know. And I felt like I needed to take a drink, you know. I felt like that was the only thing that was going to make me feel better, you know. And the next morning I woke up and I went downstairs and my dad said, he said, I'm moving down to Virginia. He said, and I don't even know to this day why he asked me or why I said what I said, but he said, do you want to come with me? He goes, I got reunited with this woman I was seeing in high school, and he's like, I'm going to move in with her. And I said, sure, I'll move down with you. And I didn't want to leave. I didn't want to leave that life I was living. It was exactly what I wanted. All I did was drink. That was it. That's what I wanted. I didn't want a job where I had to show up to every day. You know, I didn't want to start a family when I was older. All I wanted to do was drink today. You know, that was it. But I told him I would, you know, and he said, if you move down there with us, things are going to have to be different. I'm like, yeah, that's great. Things will be different. You know, I'll go back to school. I'll get a job for the summer because it was April. I couldn't start school when I moved down here. So I moved here and I didn't get a job, obviously. You know, I didn't want to do anything. You know, my stepbrother was, he was like 28 years old and he drank just like me. You know, he's been sober in the rooms a few times. He's not sober right now, but you know, he drank just like I did, you know, and he had a lot of money, and he would just supply me with alcohol or whatever I needed, you know, and that was it. That was life for me, you know. I had a great big huge house to live in and free alcohol all the time, you know, and this other guy moved in, and he was a dealer of other substances, you know, so that worked out good for me too. And you know, I mean, I'm telling you, it wasn't like a crazy house. This guy was like, you know, he was like clean cut, and so it worked out good for me. I loved it, you know, and I was the happiest I had ever been, you know. I still didn't have a relationship with my dad, you know. I still gave him the stink eye every time I looked at him, you know, and I could tell that I was killing him, you know. That every time I looked at him, he just was like, why can't you be like your brothers? Why can't you be like everybody else? Why do you have to be this way? And I mean, he never ever once said that to me, you know. He would just try to help me if I had ever asked for it, you know. He would give me whatever I needed if I asked him, you know. So I lived through the summer like that, you know. And I had gotten into a few screaming matches with my stepmom, you know. 6 months after I met her, I'm screaming at her, you know. She said, you need to move back to Boston with your mom. Now, I tell you how I didn't like my dad, how I hated my dad. My mom, I was even, you know, I didn't want anything to do with my mom. You know, she left us when we were 13, and, you know, she had given up, you know. I didn't want to move back with my mom, so I tried to change my ways and enrolled in school in September, Fairfax High School. And I lasted 2 months, and I got expelled after 2 months. Now I like to think that I'm like this big, tough guy, you know, but I'm not. I was like 97 pounds, like 5'7", and there was this big, huge security officer, okay, and I was in in-house detention for the day, for whatever, from the day before, and uh, The security guard went to the hallways. When the kids pass in the hallways, he watches the hallways. So I got up out of the detention room, and I tried to kind of shove him out of the way to look into the hallways. And he was like, go back to your seat and don't touch me ever again. So I went like that, touched his hand like that, and they arrested me for assault. And I was like, that's right, I'm getting arrested. And all the kids are passing in the hall, and I'm in handcuffs. And it felt so great, like I was this big, tough guy, you know. And he put me in the police car and shut the door, and I started crying because I was so scared, you know. I was terrified. And I was mostly scared because I was sober, you know. I didn't have anything to take that edge off, you know. I didn't have anything to feel okay, you know. And I just want to say, that's when I was sober is when I acted the most crazy. You know, I felt like I was a pretty decent guy when I was drunk. I was nice to everybody. Perhaps I would open a door every once in a while for an old woman or something. And I was that kind of guy, you know. But when I was sober, I was a maniac. You know, I would scream at people. I would yell at people. I would tell my dad I hated him. I would do things to be hurtful because I was hurting inside, you know. And so I got expelled from that school, and my stepmom was like, that's it, next week we're shipping you back to Boston. And she said, unless you start going to meetings with your stepbrother Kevin. And Kevin, he owned a business, and his business was Then he said, I heard you're coming to a meeting with me tonight. What time are we leaving? And I said, I don't know. I said, and I don't really want to go to one of your meetings. I thought it was something to do with this company. And he said, well, it's an AA meeting. He said, and there's a lot of young people there. He said, and you have no, he's like, you have no friends around here. And he goes, and there's a lot of people there. So I went to a meeting out in Bethesda called Saturday Night Special on, I mean, it's in Bethesda, and there was about 200 people there, and I was so scared of that meeting. You know, everybody, I hear this all the time, but everybody was smiling and happy, you know, just like in here tonight, you know, introducing themselves to me, and I wanted nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. My father just wasn't there enough when I was younger. That was my problem, you know. I just couldn't be good enough at sports like my older brothers were, you know. That was my problem. Drinking is what made me feel better. That was my solution. And if you take that away from me, I'm going to be a maniac the rest of my life, you know. So I started acting out again, you know. And I participated. I didn't participate in the meeting, sorry. I sat through the whole meeting, and I wasn't really interested in listening, you know. But I remember hearing a couple of things, and I remember at the end when they held hands, and I was like, this is unbelievably ridiculous. Like, come on, guys. Just don't drink. I can do it. I can just not drink. I tried to just not drink by myself, you know. That first meeting I went to was September 9th, 2001. Just about 9 months before my actual sobriety date, 10 months. I would go home from meetings, and I would drink every single night. Well, at that point, actually, I had only gone to the meeting on the 9th, and then I went to one on the 12th, which was my new sobriety date, and because I had to have one. I felt like I had to have one to go to the meetings, you know. And I went to a men's meeting on September 20th of 2001, and this guy Todd came up to me, and he said, I've seen you coming around. He said, do you have a sponsor yet? And I said, no, and I was kind of like, you know, how much does a sponsor pay you to come to meetings? So I didn't, man, that's all I knew a sponsor was, you know, he pays you to do things. And he's like, a sponsor doesn't pay you, a sponsor is somebody you give your inventory to. And I'm like, what's an inventory? I don't have many things, you know, I don't have much of an inventory. And, you know, I was a very, 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 very slow learner. And he said, why don't we do this? He said, why don't you just call me every day when you get home from school? Because I was going to another alternative school by this point. And I said, okay. And then I waited 3 days, and I called him, and I said, hey, Todd, this is Johnny. He said, who's Johnny? He said, Johnny who? And I said, Johnny, your sponsee who you never call. And he said, it's your job to call me. He said, it's not my job to track you down. And I was like, you know, that's kind of mean. And So I started calling him every day, you know, and I was going to meetings every day, and I was semi-listening during meetings, you know. I was perpetual motion. That's what my sponsor talks about, sitting in the meeting when I was new, you know. I was just moving all the time. My legs were shaking. I was trying to crack my back or crack my neck and cracking my knuckles, distracting everybody. And I would try to sit in meetings, and I would try to listen. I would get about 7 to 9 minutes of good listening in, you know, and I would start sweating, and I would have to get up and go to the bathroom, but that first 7 minutes of the meeting, I would listen to how it works, and in how it works, in the first paragraph, it talks about being honest, I think 5 times, it says the word honesty, and I was a very, very, very dishonest person, you know. I would lie. I had, like, my whole life was like, it's like me in the center, and then it branched out in a web of lies to everybody in my life, you know, that's how it was, and that was a headache in itself, trying to manage all of those lies, you know, and trying to back them up to everybody. And I was still drinking, not telling anybody about it. And my sponsor called me. Oh, I called my sponsor, and he said, I want to get you started on a 4-step. And it's in the big book. I want you to read it, and we're going to talk about it tomorrow. And I made up this grandiose list of lies and, like, things that I, like, wanted to do that I thought was, like, being, like, a bad, you know. Because I wanted to be worse than I actually was, you know, because I wanted to fit in. I wanted to be the worst turd in the bowl, you know. Because I had heard people saying in meetings that the sick you are, the more we love you, you know. And I was like, I need to be loved, so I need to be more, you know. So I made up this list of lies and dishonest resentments and dishonest secrets and read it with my sponsor, and I felt nothing, you know. And then 2 weeks later, he was like, I'm moving to Florida. He said, I can still sponsor you if you want to. And I said, I want to have a sponsor. I talked to a couple people about it, and I said, I want to have a sponsor who can, you know, be around and hold me accountable. You know, I had, like, no time sober, you know. So I was still drinking, still, and I got another sponsor, and I did another 4-step, you know, and I decided to be a little bit more honest on this one, you know, and I was a little more honest, and I read it to him while we were walking through Walmart, which was absolutely terrible, you know. I'm like, everybody's listening, this is ridiculous, and that guy was really just a close friend, and I needed a sponsor who I could be honest with, you know. And I couldn't be honest with him because I wanted to look a certain way to him, you know. And I switched sponsors again. I got this guy Arthur, and Arthur, I think he's the reason why I stayed sober, you know. I got him. I think it was June of 2002 now, and I was still drinking, going to meetings, still drinking, not telling anybody about it, and all. Arthur would share his inventory with me, okay? He would tell me the things that he was doing. You know, he would tell me the things that he was telling his sponsor that he was doing wrong or in his life. And I really respected that a lot because I couldn't be honest to anybody, you know, but he could be honest to me. And I started telling him, you know, 3/4 truths, you know? And in the book it says, half measures avail you half. You know, it says, half measures avail you nothing. And that's like the way I was living, you know. I was doing half measures and I was getting nothing in return, you know. So I started being like 3/4 of the way honest with Arthur. And I was still getting nothing, you know. My life was still miserable, you know. I would leave meetings and I would still feel like, I would just feel awful. You know, I would go home and why can't I feel like I belong to this group of people? You know, probably because I'm still drinking. And Arthur, I went back to Boston to visit my family for July 4th. And I stayed there from July 4th to July 14th, maybe July 17th. And I drank the whole time I was there with my old friends, you know. There was not even a second that I was like, I'm not going to drink while I'm here, you know. I couldn't wait for the plane to land so I could get drunk. And my friends picked me up, and we started drinking. We went right to his house, and we started drinking. And I did that for the whole week. I went to 4th of July with my family, which was unbearable, sober. You know, they're all drinking and having a great time, and I'm like, come on. Like, July 5th, here we come. And, you know, the next day, that's what I did. I started drinking. I drank all the way to, I'm not sure, actually, if it was sometime before the 17th when I had my last drink. So I'm not actually 100% sure, so I made my sobriety date the 20th. Because I know I had no mood altering substance in my body at that time. You know, I was completely sober, and but I was still a maniac. You know, I was by no means cured of alcoholism. Although I thought I would be eventually. it's funny. I'll tell you a story why that's funny in a minute here. But my sponsor, Arthur, fired me because I was belligerent, you know. I was just a complete jerk. You know, I would call him and I would just mock him or mimic him. And he was finally like, he's like, that's it. Don't call me anymore. He's like, I can't help you. I cannot help you stay sober. And I got this guy, Frank. And Frank was, he was a tough guy, man. He was a tough sponsor. He was a yeller, you know. He liked to yell and curse all the time. And he was actually the only sponsor to ever make me cry. And, you know, I did a very honest four-step with Frank, and I got this sense of, just like it talks in the big book, you know, I was able to look people in the eye, you know, and I got that from that four-step, and I felt good. I felt good after I did the fifth step with him, and I rode that out for like a year and a half. I didn't take any more steps, and I stayed sober, I think, on the fourth and fifth step for a year and a half, and I started becoming that crazy person again, you know. I couldn't be around people without being a jerk. You know, I was unbearable to be around. In fact, if you ever go to my home group and you ask them how I was when I was in my first 5 years, that's what they'll tell you, you know. And, they're very honest people. And, you know, one night I was very, very close to drinking, and I remember I had got in a direction from my sponsor, and I didn't like it. And I decided, I was like, I'm not calling him. I'm not going to call him anymore. You know, I didn't call him for 3 days. And I went to a meeting that I never, ever go to. And there was this guy, Thomas, from Chicago, who was new to the meeting. And he shared something in the meeting, and he said, it's one of my favorite things, actually, that I've ever heard him say. He said, my life can be like this. I can be in a line at Subway. This is kind of what untreated alcoholism looks like. I can be in a line at Subway, and I order a sandwich, and they put it in the microwave, and I'm like, come on, I don't have all minute to wait for the sandwich to be done. Let's go. And that's where my life was. I was so impatient all the time, you know. I heard him share that, and I never, ever did this. And I went up to him after the meeting, and I said, thanks for sharing, I related. And I saw him that same Wednesday at a different meeting. You know, I asked him how long he had sober, and I thought he had like 5 or 6 years sober, you know, because that's how much of a maniac. I had 5 years sober at the time, and I was a maniac. And I was like, this guy's going to have like maybe 5 more years than me. Maybe he's got like 8 or 9 years. You know, he sounds like he knows what he's talking about. He had 28 years. And I felt a little embarrassed, you know, and I started talking to Thomas. You know, I started not even my inventory stuff. I just started talking to him, you know. And he had something about him that was calm and peaceful that I wanted, you know, that I had never felt before. And actually, that's not true. The only time I ever felt joy was when I was 15 years old and my team won the championship in baseball. That was the first time and the only time I'd ever felt joy in my life, you know. And so I eventually asked Thomas to sponsor me. You know, I went on a trip with him, and I was a maniac. You know, on this trip, and we were driving out to a golf course that was about an hour away, okay, and he laid into me for that entire hour, before he was my sponsor. But this is what I did, is I listened to every word he said, and I honestly felt like I wanted to make a difference and try to change myself, you know, and which is impossible. I cannot change myself, by the way. And so we got back, and about 2 weeks later, you know, I asked him to be my sponsor, you know, and he put pen to paper right away. You know, he said, this is what you're going to do. He said, take out a notebook. He said, write down all your unmanageability on a piece of paper. And I did it. And it was like 5 things. You know, money, whatever. And I was like, that was easy. And I brought it to him, and he's like, well, what about this, and this, and this, and this? And I'm like, you know, like oh, yeah, there's that too. And then he said, I want you to go home. He goes, take a couple weeks and think about all this stuff. Think about, this is where you've gotten your life to. And I was incapable of having relationships because I was so fearful all the time. I was so afraid of what people thought of me. I acted like a completely different person, you know. I acted like a chameleon. However you wanted me to be, that's how I would be. However she wanted me to be, that's how I would be. You know, however my dad wanted me to be, that's how I would try to be. And I did that. I sat with this stuff for like 2 weeks. And one day we get in a car ride, and he's like, so do you think you can fix all that stuff? And I'm like, yes. Yes, I do. And he's like, you know, pretty much you rockheads. You can't fix it. You know, only God can take that stuff away from you. Only God can do that for you. And, you know, we started in the second and third step. And I had never done a first, second, or third step, you know. When I was coming around, they said, your first step was going to meetings. Your second step was going to meetings and helping out. And, you know, I mean, I believed that for a long time, but I have a different opinion now, you know. And I believe there's action in every single step, you know. And I started to trust my sponsor, you know. I started to trust Thomas. And because really, legitimately, my life was getting different. Now, I had ruined like every relationship that I ever been in with a woman, okay? And I didn't know how to talk to women. I didn't know how to treat women, you know? And but I tried my best, you know, I did. I tried my best and I ruined every relationship. And I had more relationships with women than with guys. And Thomas said, this was his first direction to me after the first step. He said, you're no longer allowed to talk to women for 30 days. No. He said, and I tell you what, and he'll tell you after the meeting if you ask him. We were driving down up the tubes, you know, and it's about a 25-minute drive. And he told me within the first 7 minutes of the drive. And I couldn't even look at him. I was so mad I couldn't even look at him. And I was staring out the window. And he would talk, and I was, yeah, uh-huh, whatever, you know. And I was so mad. I was like, what about the girls who are really my friends, you know. And he's like, you better call him tonight and tell him you can't talk to him until such and such date. And I did it, you know, and I slipped up a couple times, and I talked to one of my girlfriends, and you know, I told him about it. I didn't lie about it. I told him about it that day that I talked to her, you know. And he joked around with me, that's 2 more weeks, you know, that's 3 more weeks. you know, but I'll tell you what, that simple direction, it may not seem like very much, but I'll tell you what, that was life-changing stuff for me, you know. And the reason he gave me that direction was not because I didn't know how to have relationships with women. It was because I didn't know how to have relationships with men. And he said, you need to learn how to love men before you can love women. And that in itself, those 30 days of building relationships with men in Alcoholics Anonymous changed my life 100%. You know, and in that time, I did a third step with him. And we went over to a meeting that we frequented on Tuesday nights. And it was a big book study in Virginia. And we went into the sanctuary, and he read Dr. Bob's third step prayer to me, and then this is really what floored me. He said a prayer for me to God, and out loud so I could hear it. And I'm sure people have prayed for me in the past, you know, but I'd never heard it. You know, I'd never heard anybody care for me like that, you know. And I mean, I was floored. He left, and he was like, I want you to pray for whatever, 5, 10 minutes. And I did, you know, and I thank God for being sober and for showing me a sponsor like that. And, you know, and I asked him, you know, I mean, I kind of recited Dr. Bob's third step prayer, which is like a more extended version of the third step prayer in the big book. And, I mean, I haven't looked at sobriety since the same as I used to since that day. You know, I have a whole new respect and care for Alcoholics Anonymous than I ever have before because of that specific experience. Because of that first 45 days that Thomas sponsored me, you know, and you know, we didn't stop there. You know, we continued with the steps, you know, and I started becoming a more bearable person to be around. You know, I started being more calm and more caring for other people, you know. Less caring for myself. Not all the way stop caring for myself, but I was less caring for myself. And we did a four-step, and I was 120% honest in my four-step, you know. And I didn't want to write some of that stuff down, so I wrote it first. You know, I wrote that stuff that I didn't want to say or didn't want to write first. And the guy actually, Larry, explained it to me. He said, what you were doing in all your dishonest fourth steps, he said, is you were in too much pain to write it all down, you know. And he said, when you were healed a little bit from with Thomas, he said, you started sharing the hurt when the pain went away. And I think that was true, you know. I wrote all that stuff down, you know, and we went for a car ride, and I had a little flashlight. It was after a meeting. I think it was after a meeting. And I was like, I took a deep breath, and I started reading, you know. And I was waiting for him to be like, out of the car, you know. You can walk from here. And he didn't say that, you know. He took some of the bad stuff I said and kind of brushed it off. No big deal, you know. And I was like, wow. You know, this guy, he understands. He understands me. And that's true. You know, he does understand me. In fact, this Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place that has ever understood me, I feel like. Psychiatrists, psychologists, doctors, they don't understand me. You know, they think that this drug, you know, is going to fix me. And, I mean, that may be true for some people, but it was not true for me. You know, I needed the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous to be a different person. And, so I did that fifth step, and then on to six and seven, you know, and I was stubborn there, you know. I thought that I was only defective a little bit, you know, now that I had done some step work, you know, and that was untrue. I'll tell you what, I started working the six and seven step. Well, actually, I didn't really do much. I just prayed, and I started seeing every single defect of character in my life, you know, and after a couple weeks of that, it becomes unbearable, you know, and I was, like, forced to change, because I didn't want to be that old person anymore. I wanted people to like me for who I was, you know. I didn't want to have to pretend to be what I thought that I should be, and, you know, I was so, so selfish, you know, and that was so glaring to me, you know. I forgot to mention one thing in the fifth step. I did it a little bit differently. I did it the way it is outlined in the book, and I also did 12 questions, or 13 questions, 12, and he also had me write on the seven deadly sins. And that was tough. That was tough for me to do. Write how the seven deadly sins were active in my life, you know. I didn't want to look at that stuff, you know. And I thought that I would have like one or two things to write on. And I just started writing. On all the seven deadly sins. And, you know, so all that stuff, all those defects of character were glaring in my face. And if you read in the fifth step in the 12 and 12, there's a line that says, humility. A word often misunderstood. It becomes a clear recognition of who and what we really are, followed by a sincere attempt to become what we could be. You know, and that's what I primarily got from the fifth step, and it rocketed me into the sixth and seventh step. You know, I had all that stuff, you know, that I was for real, that I was. And I had to have God remove it, you know. I would try to not be selfish, you know, on my own, without prayer. And it wasn't working. You know, I couldn't do it. I was incapable of all that stuff, you know. I could not be lustful. I could not be greedy. I could not be any of that stuff without God. And that's when I really started praying often. You know, I started praying often in the sixth and seventh step. And, you know, just throughout the day, you know, God help me to not do that again. You know, something like that. Whatever it was, whatever small prayer it was. And it started working, you know. My prayer life now is a little bit better, you know. I can always improve on it, but he had me do an A step, and that was where I really saw the guy I was drinking. You know, I saw it a little bit in the fourth step, you know, but that A step was just, I mean, it was tough for me to write, you know, but I got a lot out of it. I got a lot out of the A step, and first name on the top of the list was my dad. You know. You know, and I mean, I could have wrote four pages on harms done for him, you know. But I wrote that big, glaring stuff. And, you know, was never a son to him. You know, told him I hated him. You know, and I mean, that was tough. That was tough to make amends. I was so scared of making amends to my dad, you know. And I remember he called me one day. And this was, I'll tell you about the men's first. You know, I went over and my sponsor gave me specific things to talk to him about, you know, and I told him that stuff. And earlier in sobriety, my dad had a heart attack. And my sponsor, Frank, at the time was like, I want you to go to the hospital and tell him you love him. And I was like, no way am I doing that. There's no way I'm going to go tell my dad I love him. I'm like, for one, Frank, it's a lie, and you've told me not to lie many times, you know. And he said, I don't care if it's a lie or not. He said, you're going to go tell him. And I went and I told him, you know. And that was kind of the only time I told him, you know, that I loved him. And I said it because I was told to. And at the end of the amends with my dad, I told him I loved him. And somebody else, I heard another speaker tell this. And it was kind of like, you know, they said to their mom, you know, I love you. And she was like, okay, and kind of hung up the phone, and it was like, Mom, I love you, and he's like, okay, hung up the phone, Mom, I love you, ditto, Mom, I love you, you too, Mom, I love you too, you know, and that's kind of how it was with my dad, you know, it was like, I said, Dad, I love you, and he said, I appreciate that, son, and a couple days later, I was on the phone with him, I said, Dad, I love you, and he said, I love you too, and I can't tell you that I wanted to hear that from my dad, you know, but I felt like I needed to, you know, he had had 3 heart attacks. Up until that point, from 2002 until now, and now he's had 4 heart attacks, and, you know, he may be around for 10 more years, maybe around for another few days, you know, I don't know, you know, but there's nothing I can do, you know, but I do know one thing, is that relationship with my dad is pretty much 100%, you know, and I don't call him asking him for money, you know, I don't call him to give him a hard time, I don't call him because I need something, you know, I call him because I want to know how he's doing, you know, and he loves it. He loves when we call him, all of his kids. You know, he loves when we all call him. And I was the one who called him the least, you know. And I'm pretty sure now I'm the one who calls him the most. And he's pretty bad at returning phone calls, though. You know, most of the time it's messages with, and I love you on the end of it. But those 3 words in itself repaired our relationship, you know. It was unbelievable, you know. So, you know, I mean, I made amends to my brothers, and they're like big, tough guys. You know, I'd stolen money from him or whatever, and I cried, and they were like, you're such a sissy, you know, look at you. You know, they're all like 6'5", like 270, you know, they're huge. And I'm like, I'm sorry. And they're like, come on, man, suck it up. And, you know, I mean, I have a relationship with all my family members, you know, today that's unlike I ever wanted it to be, you know. I just wanted to take things from them. I wanted to steal from them. I wanted to steal their alcohol. And my sponsor wouldn't have that, you know. He wouldn't have me have a relationship like that with him, you know. He wants better for me than I had ever wanted for myself, you know. Even still today, you know. And that's what we discovered in the 10th step together, you know. That my life, that pretty much I'm not above acting anyway. You know, I can act like a maniac today. You asked me before the meeting what the band-aids on my hands came from, and I really don't want to tell this story, but I'll tell it. I have this beautiful girlfriend who's sweet and loving most of the time, and I'm the same way, you know, I'm sweet and loving most of the time, you know, and we clash heads sometimes, you know, we're both alcoholics, She came home last night and I was sleeping and she woke me up and we had an argument earlier in the day and I freaked out. You know, I freaked out and I'm 7 years sober, you know, and I've worked a lot of the steps and I've had God in my life for a long time now and I beat up a door. You know, I started punching the door and I honestly felt depressed afterwards, you know. But the first thing I did was I said, I gotta call Thomas. He didn't answer, and I called my pigeon brother, Tim, and he was at the Capitals game, you know, with his girlfriend, having a great time, you know, and I'm like, you know, I'm at home beating up doors, you know, and man, I tell you what, that guy that came into Alcoholics Anonymous has changed a lot, you know, but he is not gone. My alcoholism is still there and very, very strong today, you know, and And the way that I keep myself between me and a drink is the steps, talking to a sponsor, you know, helping out anybody I can, you know. And, you know, me and Thomas just did an 11-step together last week. And I work on a golf course with my roommate. And we talk about on the way into work sometimes, we're like, how much did you pray yesterday? You know, when you were mowing a green or something. Because you can't really hear much. All you can hear is the motor running, you know. And he was going through a tough time. He just got in our relationship. And I kind of used him as like a keystone to pray a lot. You know, I was like, you got to start praying when you're mowing greens, man. It helps. And he was like, man, that's what I was doing. And so I told him to do it, so I had to start doing it, you know. And I'm like, you know, I'm out there doing whatever. And I'm just, you know, I had these oversized shoes on, right, because my shoes were getting soaked in the dew in the morning. It's so wet out there. So one of the guys at work gave me a pair of boots to wear. I'm a size 10. He's a size 13. And I'm like, you know, and we walk probably 13 miles a day mowing grass, you know, It is uncomfortable with these boots. But I heard this guy in a meeting say, he said, if you can't remember to pray during the day, put a penny in your shoe, a rubber band around your wrist. And every time you feel that penny or you feel that rubber band, you go say a prayer. So every time my feet hurt from these shoes, I would pray. And that was like every 10 steps. And it was just simple prayer. Maybe a serenity prayer or a God thank you, you know. And that's how my relationship with the guys are today. You know, we feed off each other, you know. We feed the program to each other, you know. If he's not doing something, you know, I'm telling him to do it, and I start doing it. If I'm not doing something he tells me to do it, I start doing it. He starts doing it, you know. And my whole entire life today is surrounded by people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I live with people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I work with a few people in AA. I go to meetings with people in AA, obviously. And that's the way I like it today. You know, I don't like it running the streets, trying to chase that next drunk, you know. And it's very, very easy for me to fall back into that old way of life, that old thinking that I have to punch doors to show you how tough I am, you know, instead of just praying, you know. My sponsor says it to me all the time. What's that, Johnny? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You pray? I don't say anything. I'm silent on the other line, you know. That's right. Why pray when you can worry, you know? And I'm like, oh, God, man. I get that all the time. That and learn to keep your mouth shut. But, that's actually a very, very big thing to me. If you've never read it, I suggest you go home and read page 91 and the 12 and 12. One of my favorite pages. It talks about restraint of pen and tongue and how one snap judgment can ruin a relationship for a month or even a whole year. And it is 100% true. You know, luckily that stuff that happened last night didn't ruin my relationship with my girlfriend, you know. It very easily could have. But she has a sponsor and I have a sponsor, you know, and we both use them. And without that, that's the way we act all the time, you know. Mean to each other, you know. Mean to everybody else that's close to us, you know. We don't have to live like that anymore, you know. And hopefully, we never have to drink again, you know. I mean, we don't. We never have to drink again. But it can be so appealing to me sometimes, you know, that it's just easier. It's just going to be easier to go drink. I mean, why kill myself looking at myself and doing inventories? Why do that stuff? Because I'm going to go back to that guy who punches doors all the time, you know, I can't thank you enough, Thomas, for being in my life. My prison brothers, you know, Billy's been there since I've been sober, you know. Tim and I got sober together, you know, and it's relationships with the men in my life that are saving my butt today, you know. That when something goes wrong, that's who I call, you know. That's where, and they're like, oh, I had that same experience last week. I'm like, great, you know, we're normal, you know, to each other, we're normal. And I can't thank you enough for having me out here, Billy. I really appreciate it. Thanks, guys, for listening.